spacewalks are pretty scary, and you don't know it when they're floating out in space and they're tethered to the craft, but they're moving 17,500 miles an hour around the Earth, and it doesn't look like they are, but they are. And a little tiny speck of something that hits you could be catastrophic.
Hey there, friends. Welcome back to the Happy Habit Podcast. I'm your host, Matthew. I talk health and well-being every Monday and Thursday. And a reminder, we're now on Instagram and YouTube if you want to check out the videos of these episodes. Plus, if you're getting value from this series whatsoever, please like, subscribe, share, and leave the podcast a positive review. And if you've already done so, thank you very much indeed. Now, today, Brian Mallow is joining me. He is a well-known science comedian who uses comedy to educate people and make more accessible many of the scientific topics that can perplex. He gives regular talks on science and has interviewed many of the world's Nobel laureates in the field of science and several of the astronauts who have walked on the moon. In this episode, I explore with Brian the way in which science is communicated to the public at large and the value of doing so in a relatable way. Brian tells me about his encounters with Elon Musk, Stephen Hawking, and Buzz Aldrin. We also hear about the role the media played in disseminating information to the public during the pandemic and how it might have been better. We talk about what regular people can learn from meeting very successful people who have mastered their own field and beyond, such as Brian May, Queen guitarist, who, as well as conquering the world of music, has gone on to earn a PhD in science at the age of 59. This is a fun, informal chat with Brian about many different topics, which I hope you will enjoy. Well, let me welcome you, Brian Mallow, science comedian. There's been so much bad news of late, and I kind of thought I'd like to lighten the mood on the podcast. Plus, science for very many people can be stuffy and inaccessible. And any opportunity I can get to demystify science and just make it a little bit more fun, I will take with both hands. So that's why I've asked you on today. Brian, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me. And that's no pressure at all to lighten up all the weight of the world's current situations. No pressure at all.
No pressure whatsoever. Brian, can I ask you, first of all, when this symbiotic relationship, to use a scientific term, between science and comedy first came to fruition for you?
So interesting question, because I'm a little proud of the fact that it wasn't a calculated decision. I loved science first. I grew up loving Asimov, who, like yourself, was actually a biochemist, PhD, turned writer. And most people know him as a science fiction writer, but he wrote probably way more science fact than science fiction. And he wrote in every discipline of science, plus history, world history, Greek history. He wrote an annotated guide to Paradise Lost, Shakespeare, the Bible. He wrote books of Limerick. He just wrote everything. But he was a great explainer of science and he wrote with personality and even humor. I went from science fiction to science, and especially physics and astronomy, and I loved it. And I was a great science student. So the thing is, the love of science was always there. I chose to go into the arts, but quite naturally, as soon as I was doing stand-up comedy, it was geeky. It was informed by my love of science. So it was never calculated. It's just, I'm a science and science fiction geek, and I write some pretty geeky jokes. And we all knew that I was kind of a science geeky comedian way before I hit upon the phrase science comedian. And once I had that phrase, things kind of crystallized where it's like, oh, science comedian, that describes. So I didn't set out to do it. It was more like, oh, that describes what I'm already doing. And that, just having that, the .com was available, sciencecomedian.com. And I thought that's either a really good sign or a really bad sign. Like, it's useless real estate. But things crystallized around that, and it led to other science communication stuff. So that put me on a path to doing other things. One time a client asked me, oh, so you teach kids about science using stand-up comedy. And I was like, oh no, if you're a geek, I'll make you laugh. Very different. But there has always been a bit of the teacher in me. I love turning people on to music, books, films, interesting science concepts, like weird star stuff, that sort of stuff, or how neutron stars and black holes come about, or, you know, I like turning people on to stuff. So once I had that phrase, people started finding me for other science communication ventures. So I ended up doing science communication talks and workshops, if not funny, at least making it accessible to the general public.
And are there,
does that answer? What was the question?
Are there any particular areas of science?
Did I even come close to asking that?
Oh, no, you absolutely did. No, you did indeed. Are there any particular areas of science? Because science covers a huge gamut, a huge spectrum of subjects.
Yeah.
Are there any particular areas of science that make for better material when it comes to comedy?
Well, you know, I have to say that the subjects I'm most familiar with are physics and astronomy, astrophysics. But I love it all. You know, something that's easy is anything involving animals. It's because it's just so, you know, compare, you know, you can compare human behavior to animal behavior, insect behavior. There are some things that are like, it's not very difficult to find humorous things about. It's a little harder to just, okay, make quantum physics funny. but on the other hand, I see these connections like between physics and comedy. Like, I always think, like, you know, a joke has a setup and a punchline, and it's almost like action and reaction in physics. So I do see a lot of resonances. And, you know, you can make almost anything funny. It's not always easy to find the perspective, but sometimes you can fall into an analogy or just the right sort of perspective. Weirdly, like the inverse square law is a thing in physics. People may not recognize it by its name, but the idea is it describes how some forces fall off. Like gravity falls off as the inverse of the square of the distance, which only means if you're twice as far away, gravity is four times less. If you're three times as far away, it's nine times as less. You squared. If you're 10 times farther away, it's 100. The strength of gravity is 100 times less. Illumination is also like that. If you're 10 times farther away, you can even imagine like a star and light is coming off in a sphere. And the light that's hitting you, if you go 10 times farther away, that sphere has expanded. And the piece that's hitting you it's 100 times smaller, it turns out. So I like taking that and going, if someone's being annoying, if you could just get four times farther away, they would be six times less annoying. You know, so it's like, it's a matter of perspective, and it's not always easy, but I think almost anything you can find some humorous angle.
I thought it was funny looking through one of your many, many videos online. You speculated at one stage about mothers forcing their children to stand up straight being the reason we have evolved to walk upright. I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah, mothers tell their kids to stand up straight. What if that were the driving force behind the evolutionary trend to walk erect? Mothers nagging their children, stand up straight. Don't drag your knuckles when you walk. Analogies are great. I noticed a long time ago, whenever my mom would lose weight, my dad would gain weight. And when my dad lost weight, my mom gained weight. It was like the conservation of mass within our family. I had a theory that you never actually lose weight. You just give it to somebody else. Fat can be neither created nor destroyed. So I'm quoting a joke there, but, and it's not true. I never made that observation. I just imagined that connection and used my family. Having a girlfriend who was a lot shorter than me. In fact, the first time I saw her, I thought she was farther away than she actually was. So those are really simple ones. And the thing is, I started out in nightclubs, primarily comedy clubs. And these are jokes that I told all three of those: stand up straight, conservation of mass, and Tiny Lisa. We have little titles for our jokes. Those jokes I would do in comedy clubs, but there were always a few jokes that you try them at a comedy club, but not many people are laughing and you want to get booked back. So you might not do the really obscure jokes. But then I realized if I had enough science people in the audience, like a critical mass of science people, that I could pull out those jokes. And that was before I came up with the phrase science comedian. I was like realizing, and in fact, I'll say this little humorous thing sometimes in my talks, that I realized I had to connect with the right audience for my act, the complementary audience for my act, the adenine to my thymine, the guanine to my cytosine, if you will. So there's a way like where you can find humor in almost any place. Some subjects are harder. Climate change is a hard subject. I've been tasked with coming up with climate change humor. And, you know, it's not easy, but sometimes you just fall into things. And I shouldn't have brought that up because I'm not sure I have a bunch of examples for you. But you know what I mean? Some things, especially when things are tragic, there is a fine line between comedy and tragedy. But sometimes if you're focused on the tragedy, it's like, well, how do I make this funny? It's just depressing.
Speaking of which, we just came through a very tragic period, not to drag things down, but obviously the pandemic. Now, during the pandemic, science was either a hero or a villain, depending on your perspective or your political persuasion. I'm just wondering your unique perspective. How did you view science and how it handled itself during the pandemic? Because your raison d'etre is to try to make science more accessible. Did you think science did itself any favors during the pandemic in that regard?
So, you know, I think there's science and there's science communication, and not always being done by the same. Some of it's done by the same. Scientists are communicating science, but a lot of the communication we're talking about is the media and not the researchers. So I think science did a fantastic job. What some people don't know still to this day is that the mRNA technology behind the vaccines was not this brand new technology. It already went back almost 20 years. It was technology. It was a platform being developed because of previous SARS viruses and maybe some other instances. And what happened is if the previous first SARS pandemic had not resolved itself, then they would have kept working on it and working on it some years ago. But what happens is it was a platform just waiting for the next opportunity to test it. And that's why the vaccines were developed so quickly, because it was the kind of platform that it's going to be the same with future problems. It's like it's a platform just waiting for a new virus that they can use it against. So the science did a remarkable job, and not only in the development, but in worldwide cooperation. I don't know if many people know this or remember it, but immediately people that were, first of all, there was a sharing of information. As soon as the virus was out, they were sequencing its genome. And a lot of times there's competition in science and people don't always share information because there's a race to the prize. You want to be there first. There was so much sharing of information. As soon as things were sequenced, they were in databases accessible to everyone. There were people working on different viruses, stopped working on the like RSV, which we now hear a lot about. At the beginning of the pandemic, I worked with an organization here called Sigma Xi, the Scientific Research Honor Society, and we did a series of interviews with virologists and food safety experts because this was totally new and let's learn a little something about it. And one man I knew, he'd been working on this RSV virus, which I'd never heard of, and for like 30 or 40 years. But they immediately stopped working on their virus and turned their lab to learn as much as they could about SARS-2. So there was this amazing international cooperation. Now, the communication part. I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. I guess there were some communication failures. I am very clear. I wish we have such a problem with people thinking they're experts on every subject. You know, like they were just experts in virology and now they're experts on the history of the Middle East, just like that. I'm not an expert in any of these. I'm not even a scientist. I'm an informed consumer of science information, but I tend to trust experts in their fields. And that's a thing that we could talk about communication. It's like, why is it people will accept legal advice from lawyers? You know, they will get their legal advice from lawyers. If they have a heart problem, they'll trust a cardiac specialist. But somehow evolution, GMOs, and climate change and vaccines are four major subjects where people think they know more, even when they know they don't have much of a science education. They just think they know more than the actual experts in the field. That's a problem we have. And unlike some ways of thinking, science changes its mind. It evolves its understanding. It's never saying this is the way it is and that's it. Science is that's not even how science works. It's always like, this is our best description of what we think is happening. And it's open to being expanded upon. Newton's law of gravity, which I mentioned, not only was it perfectly good for hundreds of years, it's still perfectly good for most situations, including sending astronauts to the moon, which actually happened, by the way. but Einstein's new interpretation of how gravity works, it didn't displace Newton's. In most cases, they're exactly the same. But in some extreme cases, Newton's is inaccurate and Einstein's is. And that's the thing. It's this, apparently, based on all our measurements, this is an accurate description of what's happening. However, we know that we'll probably expand upon it in the future. So in terms of the virus, scientists and communicators were doing their best in a completely novel situation, a new virus we've never encountered before, and they were doing their best to figure out how best to handle it. And maybe there were some major miscommunications, but I don't think it's a mark against science. I think it's that they were doing the best they can, trying to get information out, and there may have been some missteps about masking. But the thing is, and no matter what you've heard of recent studies and how they've been interpreted, I know from the experts on like environmental engineers and how things move in the air, masks do work. But there was a time at the beginning where maybe, you know, we weren't really sure the main ways this virus was being transmitted. And there was some emphasis on touching things and handheld things before we realized, no, it's mostly an airborne thing. And that's the main problem. So yeah, it's a tough one. One communication failure that I haven't heard anyone talk about is, you know, a lot of people jumped on the fact that this brand new, untested experimental vaccine, that I'm not taking some experimental vaccine. Well, I think where we failed is, to this day, me, a consumer of science news more than other news, I haven't really heard how much testing it went through. Like, I think that's a message that needed to be communicated. No. Listen to the trials that they went through and how they compare to previous viruses. I don't think we mostly were told that. Most of us didn't consume that. So people are like, experimental virus. Like, I think they could have, like, communicators, I could have been the one to do this, find this information. But I'm just saying that out there, this wasn't communicated clearly. How very many people, you know, how many people the trials involved, for how long, how much we know about their safety and efficacy, and then how does that compare to previous vaccines? And so people chose sides while not really being presented with all that information. Does that, you know what I mean? Like, doesn't that strike you as a failure of communication, not of science research, but of communication?
Oh, 100%. I think we drowned in information at the time, and there was so much noise and so much misinformation, as you say. And I think with the advent of social media contributing to that noise also, but with legacy media, really, I think there was an orgy of information consumption. And as you say, not all of that information was dispensed correctly, and not all that information was factual either.
Yeah. You know, I have a favorite bit. So I give a lot of science communication talks and workshops. And one of my favorite pieces of science communication advice is from Richard Feynman, the late great American physicist, Nobel Prize winner. He told this story of how his father used to read to him from the encyclopedia and he'd read like a detail about like this dinosaur attained a length of so many feet. And he would stop and he'd say, you know what that means? That means if this dinosaur was in our front yard and you looked out your second story bedroom window, you could be looking him right in the eyes. And Feynman said that what he did is he was translating the bare facts into what they really mean. That's the thing about this, like the virus, the trials for the vaccines. Another example is all the time you'll hear about some rocket and they'll go, it's 642 feet tall. And it's like, wow. And then my next thought is, I don't know how tall other rockets are. Like, so just telling me that number tells me almost nothing, because is that tall for a rocket? I don't know. You didn't give me enough context. That's a very simple kind of communication failure that we see all the time. And when I tell the Feynman story on stage, I'll say, for instance, here's how I think of it with my own experience. The International Space Station orbits the Earth at about 17,500 miles an hour, which obviously sounds fast, but it's that number is so outside our daily experience. But what if I told you that's almost 5 miles per second? And what that means is if you were in space and the ISS went by, in 1 second, it would be 5 miles away. Now, that first 17,500 miles an hour doesn't convey that at all. And it's the size of a football field. It's a massive structure. In 1 second, it would be 5 miles away. That tells you a lot more than just 17,500 miles an hour. It's like, it's not just a bare fact. It's like, oh, that's how fast that is. And I think that science communicators, that's an easy way that we fail sometimes, is you just give out this piece of data with no context for us to appreciate it.
That's really interesting. I've never thought of it like that. A lack of context and a lack of relatability probably add to science's inaccessibility for the majority of the population.
Yeah. And like in terms of the vaccines, you hear it, it's like everyone was like, well, that was too fast. But if you ask them, do you know anything about how long it took any other vaccine to be developed? No, you don't. And yet you have a very strong opinion that this was too fast. Do you know anything about this technology being developed for 20 years where all they had to do, and it's going to happen again? The platform already exists. I don't even understand it fully, but you know, we need some of the genetic code of the problematic virus, and boom, the next one is also going to happen fast. And like if it's even adaptable to this kind of platform. So it's like that missing context is everything.
You said to me earlier that you're a fan of astrophysics. What was it like then in that case meeting one of the astronauts, a guy called Schmidt? I can't remember his first name.
Harrison Schmidt.
That's it. Yeah. What was it like meeting a man who walked on the moon? That's extraordinary.
So you know what? It's amazing. I've met 3 of the 12 humans that walked on the moon. And you know, there aren't very many of them alive anymore. But if you went to these events, there were events that the astronauts would be at and you could meet them. But I didn't really seek it out. I just ended up at, I met him a couple times at events that I was also participating in. One was a National Association of Science Writers. And I actually have a 5-minute video interview with him. And it was just really quick. But I asked him what it was like to just stand on the moon. And you know, yeah, it is kind of surreal. He was one of the last people to walk on the moon. He was the only scientist to walk on the moon. He's a geologist. And he did describe the beauty. Like, I think he said something like that sometimes people think it's like was sterile or like what you would call like, but barren or something, but it was like really beautiful with maybe seeing the Earth in the sky and standing there. And he told me about, him, I think he fell or his colleague fell and just had a scary moment there. I asked him just the whole thing. I think about the David Bowie line in A Space Oddity about here am I floating in a tin can. I feel like, wasn't it terrifying to be in this little capsule where just on the other side of that metal is the vacuum of space? Same with you're on the moon in a spacesuit. It's like a little space capsule. And he said, no, he was like, you know, we had complete confidence in the engineers and the technology. So like that wasn't one of his fears, but you know, there are probably literally a million things that could go wrong in a space mission, and anything could fail. Like happened with a couple space shuttle missions, that one little thing could fail and be catastrophic. So there's that risk, but they really go into it trusting, we know the science, we know this is built to specs that will withstand it. And I mean, we all do it when we get on roller coasters and things, or some really scary, like you're at the top of a building and you're standing on glass and looking down 50 stories. You're trusting that it didn't break for anyone before me, and it's probably not going to break, but it seems terrifying.
All of these astronauts tend to say the same thing about them trusting the technology, etc.
Yeah.
But and they're so busy doing what they're doing and engrossed in their spacewalk, their 8-hour spacewalk, that they're not focused on the infinite nothingness behind them. But I find that really difficult to accept, because at the end of the day, if you lose contact with whatever shuttle or space station that you're tethered to, well, yeah, then you're gone, you're history. There's that brilliant photograph of that astronaut, I think, taken back in the 70s or 80s, where he...
Bruce McCandless?
Yes, this is it. You describe it there, because you're probably better describing it.
Still remember what MMU or something, they manned maneuvering unit or something. They were testing out, you know, previous spacewalks are pretty scary. And you don't know it when they're floating out in space and they're tethered to the craft, but they're moving 17,500 miles an hour around the Earth. And it doesn't look like they are, but they are. And a little tiny speck of something that hits you could be catastrophic. And so it's amazing. But they were testing out a thing that it wasn't tethered. It was this device. So he flew it away. And there's a picture of him with this device that's like a big jetpack or something. And he's nowhere near the spacecraft. And I think you can see part of the Earth. And he's just floating out there. And yeah, what if he wasn't able to get back to the spacecraft? What if one little thing went wrong? And you're just, yeah, that is amazing. And so I also met, there's an amazing event called Starmus. It's Star, STARMUS. And it's Star and Music, Starmus.
Oh, okay.
Brian May, guitarist of Queen, who attained his PhD in astrophysics or astronomy at the age of 59. He and I think who might have been someone that worked on his PhD advisor, possibly Garrick Israelian, who's also a remarkable astrophysicist, they started this event. And because of that event, at this one event in 2019, I met Buzz Aldrin, and he talked to me more than I talked to him. And but that was great. And I met Charlie Duke, who also walked on the moon. But I also met a couple of guys including Al Warden, some other Apollo astronauts who didn't walk on the moon, but they went to the moon. And, you know, on each trip, 4 trips, 3 astronauts, 2 of them each time went down to the surface. And, you know, in a way, that seems to be the flashy bit. But that 3rd astronaut had another distinction. They were alone in a spacecraft orbiting the moon, while their other 2 buddies were down on them. Now, those other 2, hopefully they'll be able to get back up and rendezvous with them. You know, they had to drop down and then relaunch back up. But that lone astronaut, 4 times, 4 different men, at some point, imagine the Earth and then the moon. And the astronauts walking on it were on the side of the moon facing the Earth. But that other guy was orbiting the moon. And at some time when he was on the far side of the moon from the Earth, they were the most isolated humans in history, where every other human is on the Earth. 2 humans are on the side of the moon facing the Earth. They are alone in a capsule on the opposite side of the moon. And when they go behind the moon, they completely lose contact for some like 20 minutes or so. I have no idea, 11, 20 minutes, however much time. They are completely out of contact, alone, floating in a tin can. And what a remarkable experience that must have been, to be by far the most isolated humans in history.
Wow.
It's not possible to be that isolated on the planet.
No, true. Even in a loveless even in a loveless marriage, you can't be that isolated.
It may seem like it, but you're really just scrunched up on opposite sides of a king size bed.
can we talk about, because you've met so many interesting people, you've met Nobel laureates, you've met Elon Musk at a time whenever he was a relatively normal billionaire, before he became the pariah that he is today.
He was just barely a billionaire at the time. I interviewed him for Time Magazine's website for a video. And that was at a time when SpaceX It was around 2009 or 10. I don't think they had launched a Dragon capsule into space yet, but they were doing tests. They were contracted with NASA, but all this great SpaceX stuff was still to come. And I interviewed them on the floor of SpaceX at their facility where they're building the rockets. And I got to go inside an empty Dragon capsule. Wow. That was later, a couple years later, launched into space, which is kind of cool. My closest, you know.
And what was he like? What was he like in person? Did you get a sense of that? Because he seems to have a very big ego. He seems to be a bit of a megalomaniac, to be honest. That certainly now that seems to be the case. But back then, was there any sense of humility about him at all?
You know, I only had about 15 minutes with him. And, you know, they brought him up. We interviewed him. There was the producer. David Clare was there. And me, and we interviewed him on the floor. And I got to say, like, you know, so I didn't get to really chat with him much outside a brief interview. He was easy enough to talk to. And I think that, like, I liked him at the time. He was nice enough, and he answered the questions. And he didn't seem particularly cocky or anything. It's like, you know, he's trying to solve a really hard problem. Space, like he talked, it's like, you know, rocket science. It's like, it is hard. It is rocket science, I think he said at one point. And, you know, they had some failures before success on some of their early launches, but you have to look at those failures as they were expected. You know, like people would look, oh, that one failed. It's like, you know, on the way to developing something, you expect to have some failures. And even though they're spectacular when they're big, expensive rockets, they were expected to. And then they were followed by a lot of successes. So, no, he seemed humble enough. Again, this was 2009, 2010, and it was a very pleasant experience.
What about Stephen Hawking? Did I read that correctly? You met Stephen Hawking too?
Yeah, but I didn't get to interview him, which would be a challenge. I just happened to get to attend. It was NASA's 50th anniversary, and he gave a talk. And at this reception afterwards, I got to just meet him. And I'm just so lucky I had the same luck with Buzz Aldrin that someone else saw me talking to him and took a picture. Oh, so I have a picture of myself with a candid. We're not posing for it. I think I was telling him an extraordinarily geeky joke that almost no one would get. And so a friend caught that moment. And with Buzz Aldrin, I have these two photos of him talking very adamantly at me. And it's nice to have that little memento of the occasion. So I didn't really get to interview Hawking or anything, but I did get to meet him. And I'll tell you, I've met some interesting people, and he's definitely the one I was most starstruck by. Starstruck by the astrophysicist.
What effect does it have on you, over and above being starstruck, but on your own psychology, whenever you meet these titans of whatever field that they have conquered, be it astrophysics or astronauts or other masters of science? What effect does that have on you and your own outlook at life and your own appreciation of science itself?
I've been extremely fortunate in that I've had almost all extremely positive experiences. For 8 years, I've had a relationship with the Lindau Nobel Laureate meeting, which is in this little town of Lindau, Germany. And it's been going on for 72 years, this meeting. And my job there is mostly to go there and interview scientists. And it's a huge 600 young scientists from 90 to 100 countries get to spend a week with a couple dozen Nobel laureates. And so I wouldn't say this would apply to every Nobel laureate, but the Nobel laureates that choose to come to this meeting, and many of them come year after year, they are self-selected to be a group of, you know, the ones that are ornery and don't want to talk to people and aren't nice, maybe they don't come to this meeting. The ones that come to the meeting, they are there for the young scientists. They've been generous enough with me and nice, even though they're not there for press or anything. And I'm not exactly press. I'm working with the meeting. But those people, and I like good example, someone I've met several times and interviewed once and was on a panel with him once, Stephen Chu. He's not a household name, but he won a Nobel Prize in physics, shared a Nobel Prize in physics. And then he was Secretary of Energy under President Obama for 4 years. So he like served in that capacity. And he goes to that meeting almost every year. Every year it's a physics meeting anyway, because they rotate through the subjects. He's an extraordinarily successful scientist. And like the other ones that attend that meeting, they care about mentorship. They care about the future. They care about the next generation of scientists, and they care about them for the impact they could have on the world and on science. So it is always interesting to talk to people that have succeeded extraordinarily at in any capacity, you know, because whatever you choose to do, literally anything you choose to do in your life, you know, you hope to do well at it. Brian May, I mentioned already, perfect example. He's a guitarist and songwriter and vocalist, and he succeeded pretty much to the absolute highest you can achieve in one of the most successful rock bands in music history. You really can't succeed much higher than that. And he wrote We Will Rock You, which I believe, when you think 1,000 years from now, what music will survive? Maybe there will still, if humans exist, or whatever we've evolved into. Maybe some Shakespeare and Mozart will still survive. And I believe that the rhythm, the boom, boom, ksh, boom, boom, ksh, I believe that will survive, perhaps without the lyrics or any, but that part may survive. And I mean, it already transcended the realm of music to go into sports arenas. And it's this other thing. It's a very strange and epic song. But, you know, just being in Queens, he built it. So he did not grow up with money, but his dad taught him how to play ukulele and guitar. And then when he wanted his first electric guitar, they really couldn't afford to buy one. So he and his dad, who was quite a craftsman, from scratch, built an electric guitar to their own specifications that was different from others in some ways. They built one electric guitar. He has played it his entire career for 50 years or more. You would think after a few years, they'd go, "Hey, Dad, now that I've played it a few years, I know some things we should do better." Nope. They built one guitar, and it's called the Red Special, and he's been playing it for over 50 years. In fact, it's probably almost 60 years now.
Wow.
And how extraordinary is that? And then he was studying astronomy before Queen, he got busy with that band. He had a co-authored paper in Nature, pretty extraordinary. And then at the age of 59, he decided to go ahead and finish his PhD, and he did. So he's Dr. Brian May. This year he was knighted, so he's Sir Doctor.
Well, listen, it's been an absolute joy talking with you this evening. Thank you so much, Brian Mallow. Really appreciate your time. What I will do is I'll pop the link to your socials in the show notes for this episode so as people can seek you out, as I did online.
And yeah, thank you so much for reaching out to me. This has been fun. I always like talking about science and science communication, or Brian May for that matter.
Well, thank you for listening to this episode of the Happy Habit Podcast. If you're enjoying listening, please like, subscribe, share, and do leave the podcast a positive review. If all that means is leaving a 4 or 5 stars if you think we've earned it. Until next time, stay happy.